Chapter 8. The carousel of horrors turned ceaselessly out in the darkness of the void, and Godolphin stepped away from the viewport, shaking his head. He tried to rid himself of the images, the illusions his troubled mind had created. He tried and failed. This, Godolphin was momentarily disoriented, and he shrugged it off. This is not correct. His gaze fell to Captain Reznor, but the Blood Angel was distracted, sniffing at the air like a hunting dog. The scent! The captain came forwards, his head tilting up to study the plasteel hemisphere in the ceiling of the Helios's bridge, the lowermost face of the navigator's habitat module. Godolphin looked up and saw something glistening around the circular rim of the pressure hatch. A trail of fluid was moving in a slow arc across the hatch's edge towards its lowest point. The dark liquid pooled and surrendered to gravity, emitting a fat droplet to spatter on the deck plates. Instinctively, the shipmaster extended a hand to catch one of the drops. Thick, coppery fluid stained his palm. "Get back!" ordered the captain, his plasma pistol rising in his fist. Another of Reznor's warriors came to the hatch control, and on his commander's nod, he pressed the emergency release. A sluice of stale blood, more than could ever have been contained in a single body, vomited out of the habitat module and flowed over the floor. Godolphin stumbled back as specks of the cold, sticky liquid struck his cheek. From inside the unlit space of the habitat, a body in wet, slick robes tumbled out, legs and arms flailing at the air. Its fall was arrested just above the deck, the corpse of the navigator suspended by trailing ropes of cable. From the smell of it, the remains were heavily decayed, but that was impossible. Godolphin had spoken with the navigator less than 5 hours ago, after they disengaged from the expeditionary fleet. "Wounds," said the other Blood Angel, pointing at the corpse. "Like claw slashes, too large to have been self-inflicted." "That pod is sealed," Godolphin insisted. "Nothing can get in or out." There was a sharp cry of horror that the shipmaster recognised as Dequan, as he spun, watching her recoil from her console, her face drained of colour. She had blood on the fingers of her hands. The lieutenant bolted up from her chair, backing away. Godolphin's first thought was that Dequan had been marked by the same backsplash that had ruined the tunic of his uniform. But then he realised that could not be so. She'd been too far away. Around the lieutenant, other members of the bridge crew were following suit, fleeing from their panels in panic. "What are you doing?" he demanded. "Mind your stations! Look sharp!" Reznor pointed with an armoured finger. "Blood," he said simply. Dequan's console, like all the others on the Helios's command deck, was an intricate and finely engineered piece of craftsmanship. It was brass and ivorite, with illuminated crystal buttons and multifunctional tabs, as elegant now as it had been when the cruiser first left the slips. It was also swimming in watery blood. Rivulets of the crimson fluid streaming out of the innards of the console, out of all the bridge consoles. The shipmaster cast around, not understanding what he saw, and found more trails of red issuing from the seams in the bulkheads and around the bowls of rivets. The Helios was bleeding. Godolphin heard a strange atonal screaming that hung in the air. It had no source. It was all around him. It was inside his head. He staggered to the viewport, his vision fogging, and fell against the armour glass wall, feeling the cold of the void outside, even through the thick protective layers of the hull. Outside, the cautious smoke let its tendrils gather around the warship and drew it in towards the dark mass of the depthless veil. By the time the word-bearers had returned to the atrium, it had been decided. "Then if Philim must have left hunters in the city, waiting for any rescue force." Carno watched as Cassiel spoke to her rocks. "Obviously, they're cloaked in some way that renders them invisible to our auspexes." "Obviously," echoed the captain, his voice ground like flint on flint. The sergeant gestured at the trampled grounds of the small parkland around them. "This area has good sight lines. We'll hold here and draw them to us. Cade has seeded the perimeter with tripwires and crack grenades." The tech marine nodded at the sound of his own name, without looking up from the data slate in his hand. Cade's servo skull was still up above them, the drone circling in the eaves of the great roof dome on an automatic patrol pattern, watching for thermal spikes, listening for the high-frequency pulses of Xenos vocalizations. "Very well." Harrocks offered nothing else, and Carno frowned behind his visor. He had expected some display of emotion from the word-bearer. The captain had just lost one of his men, and yet he behaved as if they were discussing a drill on the parade ground. The Blood Angel knew that his cousins in the 17th Legion were given to demonstrative fury and righteous rages, but he saw nothing of that in the taciturn Harrocks and his silent comrade. And considering that their search and rescue mission had barely even managed the first aspect of that description, the word-bearer seemed unconcerned by Cassiel's order to dig in and wait. When Carno tried to put a description to Harrocks' behaviour, the only word that fitted was disinterested. The warrior looked away. He longed to remove his helmet and take a breath of air that wasn't from the close, recycled atmosphere of his sealed armour, but Cassiel had given the command for all legionaries to remain hooded. The fact was, Holst's toxic air would have been painful to his lungs after more than a couple of breaths, but Carno couldn't ignore the tension building inside him, the borderline claustrophobic pressure at the edge of his senses. "I should have stayed on the flagship," he told himself. "This place is nothing but a tomb." "We sit and wait, then?" Saga asked, pausing as he reloaded his bolter. "We lose a Stormbird and two warriors, and we sit and wait?" "The enemy are cunning," Cassiel replied, his tone silencing the other Blood Angel. "Picking off lone men, fading back into the ruins. This is their territory. We have to entice them to give up their cover and strike in the open." "I've seen the Nephilim up close," noted Latio. "They're big, hard to miss. You couldn't hide one in all this." "True, but they used human slaves on Melchior," Saga pointed towards the dead. "Why not here as well?" "A conscript soldier didn't make Zagan vanish," Meros replied, "and slaves don't cut open a legionary." Cassiel made a growling noise in the back of his throat and advanced towards the centre of the park. "We'll see the enemy soon enough." He shot a look at Cade. "Any comms?" The tech marine's head remained bent, and the windrush noise of static from the multiple data channels he was sifting was faintly audible. Cassiel called his name with all the irritation of one who did not like to repeat himself. "Brother Cade, your attention!" Carno saw the tech marine's head snap up with a startled jerk, as if he'd been awakened from a deep dream. He heard the same rush sound in his ears. Far away and close all at once. He couldn't be certain what vox channel it was emanating from. "Sergeant?" Cade asked, sounding dazed. He looked at the others. "Did you hear that? On the vox? The voice?" "What voice?" said Saga. "I heard nothing." Cade glanced towards Captain Harrocks, as if he might know the answer. Five crack grenades detonated simultaneously at different points of the compass as all of the tripwires were sprung at once. The Blood Angels reflexively dropped into firing stances, weapons high, aiming in every direction. Carno felt a peculiar ripple pass through the ground beneath his feet, and the pounding in his ears became a headache. Through the atmosphere feed in the teeth of his breather mask came the distinct tang of ozone. He saw Meros and Saga looking back and forth, trying to see what to shoot at. Carno cycled the vision modes of his helmet optics, but found nothing. That didn't make sense. Even a foe beneath a camo cloak or phase shunt would leave some kind of visual trace against the background environment. There's nothing out there. The whole park shuddered and tilted downwards, earth groaning as it pitched like the deck of a watercraft in a high swell. The legionaries broke formation and went for safer ground, but there was none. It wasn't an earthquake. Holst was almost tectonically inert. Still, hab-block buildings quivered and broken glass peeled as it fell all around them. The black voids behind the shattered windows were sightless eyes. Across the atrium, a long slab of elevated highway broke in the middle and folded together, scattering vehicles as it swung towards the vertical. Carno's mouth dropped open. Instead of crumbling, the broken lines of road slapped together with a concussive crash. It reminded him of great crocodilian jaws snapping shut. Then the broken highway shifted. It was falling towards them, as if it had been directed so.
Scatter!
Cassil screamed the command into the vox, and the warriors broke apart as the shadow fell over them. The road slabs boomed as they hit the parkland, and Carno saw a blood angel vanish beneath, hammered flat in an instant. A torrent of stone dust and displaced ice wheezed up all around them in a vast blanket, reducing visibility to less than a few metres. Carno stumbled forwards, meeting Saga. The legionary's crimson armour was dirty with a layer of grey powder. Together, they forged ahead as the dust settled, moving towards other shadows that turned out to be the remainder of the squad.
"Contact right!"
called a voice, and Carno heard a raucous clattering sound. It was as if the contents of a scrapyard were being dragged up the side of a granite tor, daggers of steel crunching loudly against stone. Then the attack began in earnest. The first thing that tried to kill Carno had a lumen post for a spine, and a torso and limbs fashioned out of broken highway signs, beheaded traffic signals, and other less identifiable pieces of metal debris. It was not a battle robot, for Carno had fought with automata in the training cages and during the year-long Rust Moon War. This thing was animated by some impossible force outside his reckoning. His instinct told him it was powered by anger, and that seemed enough understanding for the moment. The scrap thing assailed with fingers made from the spokes of a wheel, fat yellow sparks jetting up from the ground where they had dragged and slashed. From gaping trash bin mouths, it spat broken screw bolts and scattershot fragments of wreckage, all of it heated to orange-white. Carno defaulted to impulse and aimed for the centre of the mass, blasting it back into its parts with a powerful three-round burst. Pieces of it clattered down around him, but they did not lie still. Twisted lengths of metal snaked towards one another, tips finding other tips, bending and braiding, making anew. He spun away. From the corner of his eye, the Blood Angel saw something tumbling out of the sky, trailing smoke. Cade's drone had been shot down, killing their best tactical advantage. More of the constructs lurched unsteadily out of the settling haze, drawing fire from all of the warriors. Most were as tall as dreadnoughts, but lacking the density of the venerable war machines. They were thin and spindly, but no single one matched the design of another. The scrap things were patchwork creations that aped the forms of simians and arachnids or equines, mad sculptures created out of street furniture and wreckage. There were dozens of them ahead, and more than that behind. Carno blinked, watching one of them come together in the manner of a vidstream of a demolition played in reverse. He could see no welds or joins holding the pieces in place, detect no electromagnetic fields. Each one of the things had a length of twisting, sinuous cable trailing away behind it, like a leash. Bolter salvos thundered around him, and he lent his weapon to the chorus, dismantling the constructs over and over. They came on, rebuilding as they went, adamantium claws scraped over the street and the tiled plaza, ploughing through drifts of snow and stamping frozen corpses into a messy red paste.
"This is what killed Sagan?"
Latio shouted, incredulous.
"What in the throne's name are we shooting at?"
For a long second, Carno felt the urge to know that answer himself. He could reach out if he was quick. Just the lightest brush of his corralled psychic powers to seek a mind or an intent behind these things. He saw his battle brothers and the word-bearers all around him. They would see, Carno told himself. They would know. It is forbidden.
"Keep firing," Cassil commanded. "Destroy them."
At once, the front rank of the junkyard abominations reeled back, resembling archers at the draw. They snapped forwards as one, and sent javelins of broken steel hurtling into the lines of the legionaries, the rods of metal ejected from their spindly torsos. One warrior went down, a rusted spear 8 metres in length going through his gut to burst out through the coolant pods of his backpack. Carno saw Cade take a glancing blow that knocked the Tech Marine off his feet.
"Fall back!"
The rest of the sergeant's words were lost in a moaning rumble from beneath their boots. pits broke open in the rockrete all around them, jagged with fangs of split brick. To Carno's horror, they worked like lamprey mouths, grinding and biting at nothing, trying to savage anything that came close. The ground contorted and rolled underfoot, the wave of motion rippling back over the entire width of the upper city atrium. In a flash of insight, Carno imagined the surface of the park as if it were a blanket cast over a great sleeping beast, just now awakening to find insects crawling upon its back. Meros fired into one of the open pits, and it actually screamed, the maw sealing up immediately, shedding thin and malodorous oil. The legionaries were being pushed towards the broken edge of the great dome, the scrap monsters coming in from all three facing sides. Carno ejected his bolter's spent magazine and slammed another sickle-shaped clip into the slot, sighting down the gun. As he fired again, he saw the buildings either side of the atrium rock back and forth, shedding more glass and debris. And then they began to twist. Against possibility, the plasteel frames of the Hab Towers coiled as the bones of a serpent would bend. The shattered faces of the buildings glittered in the icy light, the broken balconies and blinded windows taking on the appearance of shouting, angry faces. Thick cables exploded out from beneath the roadway, whipping at the icy air, fronds of plastic and copper lashing at the stonework. They moved with animal character, snaking forth in the hunt for prey. Support pillars buried in the rock ejected themselves into the air, and upper levels of the atrium complex collapsed one atop another. The mass of the buildings compacted together, breaking and reforming into a new, vast shape. Down in the heart of Holst Prime's underlevels, the lower tiers were being remade into a structure that resembled spider legs and grasping tentacles. The entire metropolis was in the process of tearing itself free of the bedrock it had been built into.
"Throne and blood!" breathed Carno, his words carried across the vox to all of his comrades. "It's the city! The city wants to kill us!"
The mad dream of it would not end. For a brief moment, Meros wondered if he had been knocked insensate during the Stormbird crash and even now lay in a healing coma, his mind dredging up this lunacy from his subconscious. No, Meros had been in that state not long ago, existing in a realm where thought was as real as flesh, and it had almost killed him. He knew this was not illusion. That would have been too simple an explanation. It seemed as if the insane reality of the nightmare landscape he experienced then had now followed him into this one. They escaped from the great dome, even as the broken edges of the crystal flex hemisphere became lips of a fanged mouth and snapped shut after them. Out in the snows of the open highway, dead vehicles under thick cowls of snow suddenly burst into motion, lurching forwards on skidding frozen wheels as they tried to bull the legionaries into the walls of the median strip. It was a hard drop from the elevated road to the surface of Holst's ice plains, but they made it, even with their wounded comrades. Cassiel's orders bid them to put as much distance as possible between them and any element of the city's infrastructure. If their enemy could call on inert objects to assault them, nowhere was safe. Meros dared to cast a look over his shoulder and saw the highway bending into ribbons, as whatever monstrous malaise had infected the city spread out across the broad bridges. That was how it seemed to him, like a great disease. An alien cancer had infected Holst Prime Hive and metastasized, corrupting it from within. Adamantium and plasteel, crystal flex and stone, all had become contaminated by some science he could not understand. That was the only explanation. Reason gave him nothing else to cling to, no other rationale that could possibly fit. But for now, the question of how this could happen was a distant second to the uncertainty of how they would survive. The city was malforming before his eyes, taking on rudiments of sessile life and ophidians, mimicking legs and grasping limbs as it assembled them from pieces of commerce malls, Hab Towers and transit complexes. Meros faltered a step as he watched Holst Prime Hive dragging itself out of the great crater that had been the base of its construction. If this Leviathan had a directing intelligence, then it wanted to be free. But more than that, it wanted death to all invaders. A tentacle-like protuberance, made of monorail trains and power cables, trailed a slow, giddy arc through the frosted air and beat at the ground, narrowly missing the line of armoured figures. Ice fractured all around, and the heavy kinetic shock pitched them off their feet. Meros collided with one of the other warriors, and they fell together, sliding towards a newly opened fissure. The apothecary used the cutting gear on his Medicare gauntlet to dig into the ice, anchoring them both. For a moment, his battle brother swung over the lip of the deadfall and then clawed his way back, scrambling to his feet once again. There was no time to share words of gratitude. The other blood angel helped him up, and then they were moving again, making for open ground. The howling wind over the ice fields warred with a stone-breaking cacophony of the mutant city's birth pangs. Rimes of fresh frost were already collecting in the crevices of Meros's battle plate, and his armor's skin sensors registered the sharp drop in temperature. Cygnus Alpha had fallen beneath Holst's horizon, and what little warmth the other suns provided was negligible. Perhaps they might be able to outrun this monstrosity, perhaps it might lose interest in them, and then they would only have to face a punishing cold that would push the capacity of their life support systems to the red line. Meros looked to where Cassiel was helping the warrior who had taken the spear hit. The compromised integrity of his armor would mean certain death. Then Saga shouted a warning, and thoughts of dying on the ice were forgotten.
Incoming!
From beneath the elevated highway at their backs, a gargantuan maggot of warped rockcrete reared up from under the frozen ground, knocking aside road supports in a rain of falling cars and broken structural antennae. It lolled and rolled, coming at them over the ice like a sidewinding snake. It had once been a service conduit for the Hive, running vox cables and geothermal taps out to the neighbouring settlements. Now it was a serpentine thing, an extension of the titanic city beast. A volley of concentrated bolter shells exploded across the splintered stone hide of the kilometre-long feeler, followed by the secondary detonations of crack grenades. The crumbling head of the thing broke off and smashed, but the main mass of it still came on, rising up, leaving the ground. Processor fluids drooled from the maw as it wavered, before diving to make a strike.
"Damn these Xenos!" shouted Latio. "There's nowhere we can go to escape this thing!"
Meros had no answer for him, until two spears of orange fire shrieked past above them and pierced the stone serpent along its length. Spheres of force bifurcated the construct and ripped it into fragments, the thrashing tail losing all coherence and falling to the ice. For a moment, Meros thought he heard a distant bellow of agony, deep and booming, like winds forced through cavernous halls of stone and metal. Then it was gone, replaced by the glorious noise of rocket engines. A great crimson hawk flashed past and performed a sharp turn upon the tip of its wing, before settling into a shaky hover on plumes of thruster exhaust. Buffeted by the heavy gale, the storm bird could not settle to land. A familiar voice crackled over the general vox.
"Scout Force, this is Captain Amit. What in terror's name have you found?"
There was a hesitance in the captain's voice that Meros had never heard before.
"I'll explain later, sir,"
Cassiel responded.
"We need to get off this rock. Before it comes back," added Saga.
Lines extended from the underside of the dropship, and the legionaries took the maglocks at their ends and connected them to their armour. Meros tried not to think of how much the recovery lines looked like the same snaking cables that had raced after them in the city, and locked on. Then Amit Stormbird powered away, reeling them in as it climbed skywards. Black-armoured hands dragged Meros in through the ventral hatch, and he was dimly aware of Warden Anellis's skull helm glaring back at him. He turned away, wiping frost from his eye slits. The apothecary's last sight of Holst Prime Hive was a giant's hand made of broken buildings atop an arm taller than an Imperator Titan. He watched it snatch at the vessel and miss, falling apart as it collapsed back towards the surface. Cassiel's squad and the word-bearers sat silently on the landing bay's deck as the beat of air resistance gave way to the smoothness of vacuum. Meros's helmet came off in his hands, and he found himself looking across at Kano. His friend's eyes were glazed and distant, focused on a point beyond the far bulkhead. A shadow fell over the apothecary, but he didn't look up. The warden stood over him, surveying the survivors, as Captain Amit emerged through the forward hatch. The sergeant rose and saluted.
"Sir, your timing could not have been better."
Amit dismissed his thanks with a curt nod.
"I brought ships to assist in the Hermia's mission. The Victus was in closer orbit, so I offered to take on the search for you myself. I wanted to look upon the enemy."
He paused.
"Is that what I saw, Brother Sergeant?"
"I'm a warrior, not a scholar," Cassio replied,
"which, begging the captain's pardon, means I don't have a first bloodless inkling of what we were shooting at."
The steady thrumming of the Stormbird's engines filled the silence in the landing bay, but not so much that Meros missed the single whispered word that fell from the lips of Warden Anellus.
"Sorcery."
A buzzing tone sounded over the Stormbird's internal box.
"Attention, this is the flight deck. Brace for combat manoeuvres."
Amit tapped the comm bead in his gorget.
"Pilot, report. We detected no other ships out here. What is the threat?"
The crew serf's voice was tense.
"It's not a ship, Captain. It's the planet. It's shooting at us."
"It doesn't want to let us go," said Carno, quietly. Sanguinius came to Holst to see for himself. The engagement was already well underway as they came into visual range. The Hermia, along with the Victus and her escort cruisers, Sable and Pale Knight, were connecting back to the planet's surface with the glittering impermanent red threads of mega-lasers. But at first, it was not clear what enemy the other ships had come across. The Primarch's flagship hove closer. The red tier, flanked by the Ignis and the Covenant of Baal, the vessels temporarily detached from the main body of the fleet out in open space. Scan, searching for conventional weapons discharges, registered only the barrages coming from the orbiting cruisers. Returns from Holst itself showed a chaotic mess of interference patterns. Then, a missile made of dense rock, most likely the head of a great mountain from Holst's equatorial zone, threw itself out of the Hive World's gravity well. A singular, incredible release of volcanic power ejected the mass into the orbital path of the Pale Knight at such speed that the cruiser's fusion thrusters were not sufficient to set it on a different heading. The collision lit a small, brief sun over Holst's night side. The starship's back was instantly broken, and it came apart in clouds of venting atmosphere and plasmatic discharges. Even as the cruiser perished, the planet was spewing more molten hate into the sky. Scattershot clouds of stone briefly became flaming meteors as they crossed the ice world's thin atmospheric membrane, against all reason screaming upwards at the Blood Angel's ships. The Victus took hits across its flank, and the Hermia lost great divots of hull metal as the hurled rocks gouged valleys in the thick armour of her prow. The Angel's wings closed tightly over his back as the Pale Knight fell away from him, vanishing into the grey haze of Holst's churning atmosphere.
"How many were on that ship?"
asked a tremulous voice from across the bridge. It was a junior rating who had spoken, protocol forgotten in the shock of the moment.
8 full squads of legionaries."
Sanguinius's reply seemed to come from a very great distance.
"Nearly 100 times that number of crew."
He didn't look away from the great viewing window as he gave a new order.
"Admiral Ducade, action orders to all ships. Draw back from Holst, beyond the range of those attacks."
The command was passed on, and they drew away, seething comets of magma snapping at their sterns. The Primarch's guard commander bent over the flagship's hololith, grimacing. The panes of data and imagery streaming up from the scrying arrays were outside his comprehension.
"The mass index of Holst is altering," said Ascalon,
reading the impossible words aloud.
"The planet's dimensions are shifting. It's shrinking. Changing."
"The same as Forus,"
offered Zuriel from his side.
"Another sign?"
"No,"
Sanguinius shook his head. "This is something else." He pointed.
"See?"
Behind the Victus and the other vessels, the blue-white world was becoming a bald fist of ice and rock, wreathed in a halo of blackened ejecta of such turbulent power that the glittering ring system around Holst was breaking up.
"What kind of weapon can fire objects of such dimension from a planetary surface?"
Ascalon looked up, questioning anyone who would meet his gaze.
"There's no mass driver ever built that could do it. The power requirement alone would be immense."
But none of the crew, human or legionary, could look away from the great viewport. Centred in the great armour-glass window, Holst's surface was partly visible through clouds of volcanic ash and chemical fog. It resembled a seething mass of colossal serpentine forms shifting and changing. The icy landscape had become a cancerous husk in constant motion, and the writhing form played tricks on the eye, seeming to resemble faces that bellowed and spat. When the sanguinary guard's master spoke again, there was a wintry, rigid fury under every word that he uttered.
"Our blood will not be shed by those who dare not show themselves. There will be no death without reciprocity here. On my legion, I swear it."
"Contact from Captain Amit," reported Zuriel. "The Victus, Sable and Hermia are entering formation with us. Hermia reports major damage, but is still operational."
He hesitated.
"Orders, my lord?"
"This ends," said Sanguinius. "Admiral Ducade, slave gun control on all vessels present to my word of command. Tell every shipmaster to prime their cyclonic torpedoes and mega-weapon gauge systems for full bombardment. Target Holst."
A ripple of uncertainty passed through the human crew at the thought of such mammoth overkill.
"All weapons? Against the Hive City?"
Ducade asked.
"Against the planet," corrected the Primarch. "Synchronize aim points along the equator. Track for geological flux. I want this world shattered."
Ascalon felt a chill run through him. The hammer of the Emperor's will was a powerful force, and in the wars of the Great Crusade, it had often been regrettably necessary to punish whole worlds with ruthless intent. The guard commander had seen cities wiped off the map in the blink of an eye, vaporized by lance cannons and macro-nuclear bombs. Continents seared by laser barrages, skies scorched. And while the power to kill a world, to truly, utterly destroy it, had always rested within the reach of the Legionis Astartes, it was not an order that Ascalon had ever witnessed in execution.
"All shipmasters report guns at ready."
Ducade read back the status in a dead voice, as if she was unwilling to believe what would come next.
"Your will, my lord."
Ascalon did not feel any less of the Primarch's anger at the destruction of the Pale Knight. He knew that no one aboard these sister ships felt otherwise, but the act of war that was before them still gave him pause. Finally, Sanguinius turned away from the great window and looked his old friend and comrade in the eye. In the angel's noble face there was at once a great distance that reminded Ascalon of just how far his master was set above even his superior transhumanity. And within it, he saw a determination dense as neutronium, and equally unbreakable.
"My patience with this shadow play is at an end," said the Primarch,
and the word seemed to be for Ascalon alone.
"The order is given. Exterminatus extremis."
The void surrounding the planet Holst flashed crimson as energies were liberated and directed, as a surge of weapons of mass destruction hurtled from launch tubes and bore down upon the turbulent world. Energy pulses struck first, moving at the speed of light and boiling away the vapours shrouding the sky, punching into the nitrogen ice surface. Rocky understrata that had been sealed beneath permafrost for millions of years were burned clean and exposed. The torpedo barrage came seconds after, great fusion-powered rockets tipped with lethal warheads. Each had the power to lay waste to a continent, but in this instance, they were combined with force enough to spear the molten heart of a world. Whatever unreal influence had spread its cancerous instrumentality through Holst Prime Hive spilled into the matter of the planet itself. On some primitive level, Perhaps the world had even become alive, transformed by dark power into an almost consciousness. But it died now, perishing in revenge for the deaths of the crew of the Pale Knight, for Brother Zagan and all the other legionaries, dying for the offence its existence gave to the angel Sanguinius. Like a tormented animal, the planet ended with a tortured scream that even the void could not silence.